Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon here as part of Faith Explored on Premier Christian Radio. And I've got a really interesting discussion coming up for you today on two experts on biblical archaeology and whether current archaeological finds support the New Testament narrative. I'll be introducing my guests Shahar Shiloh and Byron McCain in just a moment's time. Unbelievable, if you want to find it online, subscribe to the podcast, look at some of the resources and videos that we've got available, all available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. A few people have said, where's the Unbelievable conference this year, Justin? We had in July last year Unbelievable conference 2014. Well, we've had a 1 year break from the conference, planning to come back in 2016 with a conference, but we are aiming to set up a debate event in the autumn. Look out for details of that, where you'll be invited to come along in London and hear a top class debate. So we're hoping to do something live and public soon on the show. So keep your ears to the ground for more details of that, hopefully in a few weeks' time. But for those who missed the conference, you can always, of course, go and watch the videos from last year's conference. All of them now available at the website under the videos section for the conference. So premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We're going to be hearing some of your feedback later on in today's programme. After Unbelievable today, Matt Redman speaks to Steve Fanstone about his life, career, music, worship and some extraordinary stories as well. That's on the profile between 4 and 5 today with the well-known worship leader Matt Redman. So lots to look forward to and get you thinking this Saturday afternoon as ever. Right now, let's get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today we're asking on Unbelievable, does archaeology support the New Testament? Shahar Shiloh is a biblical historian and archaeologist who's going to be visiting the UK soon to host a number of seminars discussing some of the new archaeological finds, which he believes reconfirm the narrative in the New Testament. He's speaking across the UK from June the 22nd to Friday the 26th of June. More info on that from walkwherejesuswalked.com. My other guest via Skype today from the US is Dr. Byron McCain. He's a biblical archaeologist, professor of religion at Swofford University, South Carolina. He's been involved in many excavations and digs in his research, some liken him almost to Indiana Jones. But he says that we don't dig to prove or disprove the Bible, we dig to enrich our understanding of the world of the Bible. So they're my guests on today's programme. Hope you enjoy what we've got in store for you. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon as well, sir.
Good afternoon. Let's begin with you, Shahar, before we speak to Byron. Tell us how you got involved, being interested in the archaeology of Israel and the Middle East, and where that passion came from.
Well, that subject has drawn me into it with a lot of passion when I was already in school. And, you know, guiding tours all around and walking the land in many, many paved roads in the Judean desert, in the Galilee, in the Negev desert and the Eilat region. And as you go everywhere within Israel, there are huge amounts of archaeological sites. One cannot just take his eyes aside. Anywhere you walk, you'll see them. And it's interesting, so I wanted to know, what is it? It's on my way, it just, you know, popped up here and there. And as I knew nothing back then, and, you know, back then knowledge was only in the books, not like today, which you can look at the palm of your hand and play with your iPhone. So I needed to go into the libraries, into the books. And that's the way I got into university, when I demobilized from my service, straight into university. And ever since, I never stopped.
Just give us a flavor of what you're going to be talking about when you're here in the UK towards the end of June.
Well, my lectures would be aiming very much towards the affirmation of the Bible and the New Testament through the world of archaeology. And like my friend, as a scientist, I'm not looking for the Bible. I'm looking for enriching my knowledge, and the evidence that comes out of the ground many, many times do support the Bible. Sometimes they don't. Mm-hmm. But what is interesting for us is, yet, whatever comes out of the ground in the last 150 years of excavations in Israel does not disprove the Bible. Either it goes along with the Bible, and sometimes it doesn't, which is fine.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Anyhow, so I'm going to talk about the place where they meet.
Yes. And what have been your particular areas of most research recently? I know that you're doing a degree in the City of David, Jerusalem, and so on.
Yeah, well, I'm currently writing my PhD in the Haifa University over the biblical city of David. I've already participated in two different other researches. I wrote two masters, both within the historical ancient biblical land of Israel. One of them dealt with the city of David. Another one dealt with the ancient Nabataean perfume and spice roots in the southern Negev. So I was involved in different researches. My fields of expertise would be mainly the desert and the Negev, mm-hmm. on one hand, and biblical Jerusalem and times of Jesus. I call that from David to Jesus, all the biblical times from in between, you know, the kingdom of Judea and David and the times of Jesus, which is Roman times here in King Herod. That would be my field of expertise within Jerusalem.
When it comes to the when you're walking around Jerusalem and parts of Israel and so on, you know, we talk about walking where Jesus walked. But in fact, I mean, how far down do you have to dig to get to the remains that were, if you like, at the time 2,000 years ago when Jesus and his disciples were walking the streets?
Well, that's an interesting question, my friend. And my colleague, Professor McCain, could answer that even better when his turn comes, because some places in Israel, you dig as much as 1 foot, 2 feet sometimes, and you're already there, 2,000 years old, in the times of Jesus. Some places where you come to what we call tells, or mounds of excavations and rubble and debris, you need to dig as much as 45 to 50 feet, something like 15 meters, because many cities in Israel were ruined and rebuilt again, one upon the other, and that gives you a lot of layers in order to get 2,000 years before our time. So in Jerusalem, sometimes we go as deep as 15 meters to get to the times of Jesus.
Are there then places, I suppose, where you can literally say, I'm walking on the same stones that Jesus walked on?
Well, there are a number of places which I can say that very certainly, that I can tell my visitors, my clients at the time, that the pavements they're walking on were paved in the times of Herod by King Herod and his masons. Mm. And therefore, if the place is being described in the New Testament as a place where Jesus walked, and I'm walking on the same pavement from the Roman times, first century, you know, which is Jesus' times, then very much certainly I can talk and say that this is where he walked, unlike the Byzantine era, which most of the things are replicas, basically, because they were built in the Byzantine era 500 years after Jesus walked on these same pavements.
So there's a kind of a degree of confidence you can have with some parts of the parts that have been uncovered. It's interesting stuff, and we're going to be exploring this today with the help of another guest, Dr. Byron McCain from Swofford University. I likened you to Indiana Jones, Byron. I think I don't know whether it's quite as exciting as Indiana Jones's life doing the archaeology. Why have you earned this reputation exactly?
Oh, I think that you know, most people, when they think of archaeology, think of Indiana Jones, and you know, God bless Harrison Ford for making us so sexy and interesting. We owe him a debt we could never repay. You know, he recently had an accident, Harrison Ford, and I hope he has recovered fully, because, as I said, he's made us all into celebrities.
you do have
if
a very
ever meet an archaeologist who claims they were not inspired by Indiana Jones, they're lying.
You do have a hat that makes you look rather the part for Indiana Jones. I've noticed in some of your shots. But tell us a little bit about what drew you towards wanting to devote your life to biblical archaeology.
Well, I was well into my PhD work when I decided to take an archaeology seminar, mainly because the professor was world-renowned for his work in archaeology, my mentor, Eric Myers, but also because archaeology intimidated me a little bit. Let me tell you, it's a lot easier to just sit and open the Bible and read what's on the page than it is to try to cope with the complexities of space and time that are in an archaeological report. So I... In fact, I was quite intimidated by archaeology, and I've always had a little stubborn streak, my mother always told me. And I just decided that if it was hard, I was going to roll up my sleeves and figure it out. And along the way, I fell very deeply in love with it. My sister, my older sister, teases me. She says, "You don't fool me with this archaeology routine. You're still that little guy who liked to go out and play in the dirt." And, you know, there is a kind of sensory enjoyment of being out in the sun and have your hands in the dirt and find things that haven't seen the light of day in thousands of years. Yeah, I'll get up early to do that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Just describe to me what that looks like then. How long might you be working on a given location to uncover, I don't know, the remains of an old house or a road or digging for pottery or whatever it might be?
Well, as Shahar was saying, you know, that depends on the site. For example, right now we're working on a hilltop site, and hilltops tend to be breezy, and so the accumulation of soil is not as permanent, not as great. And so at our site, you kick your toe in the ground, and you're in the Byzantine period, you know, 400 to 500 A.D. So, and we... again, on a hilltop site or at Khirbet Khana, where I've also excavated, you scrape your trowel a few times and you're hitting ancient walls.
Wow.
But in other contexts, for example, over at Sepphoris, you can dig for a while before you get into the ancient period. So it all depends.
Now, we heard what this quote I gave earlier, we don't dig to prove or disprove the Bible. We dig to enrich our understanding of the world of the Bible. In that sense, you're doing it, you know, with an objective purpose of looking into this. But as you've done that, would you say that what you've found has served to confirm, disconfirm, or simply be neutral on the accounts as we find them in the New Testament of Jesus and his day?
Oh, it's both. You know, there are times when the correspondence and coherence between text and artifact is breathtaking. And there are other times when you look at it and you realize, okay, this writer really doesn't have firsthand experience what they're talking about. Maybe I could give two quick examples.
Okay, go ahead.
First of all, in the case of the Gospel of Luke, when he describes the miracle at Capernaum of the lame man when they dig a hole in the roof and let him down, Luke says that they removed the tiles in the roof. Mm. Well, the excavations at Capernaum have turned up a grand total of zero roof tiles. The roofs at first century Capernaum were made of beams and packed earth and straw. That's why Mark says they dug through the roof above him. So Mark has been there and Luke hasn't.
Okay.
Luke lives in a world where all the houses have roof tiles, and that's the world of the major cities of the Roman Empire. So that's a place where, on the one hand, for Mark, we get confirmation. He knows what he's talking about. With Luke, we go, oh, he's heard this story secondhand, and when he hears roof, he thinks roof tiles.
And he's made a kind of an assumption at that level.
Right, yeah. Right. And archaeology very often illumines for us what the writers have assumed.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting example of sort of something I'd never thought about, but where, yes, you'd get a kind of a real sense of the nature of the architecture of a building and that kind of thing. There was this story a little while ago as well, purported to be possibly the house of Jesus has been discovered. Do you want to sort of give us a sense of that, just how likely it was to have been the house of Jesus the story around that?
Yeah, I mean, like most archaeologists, I heard that claim and looked at the photographs with amazement, because that house is directly adjacent to a first century tomb.
Okay.
And as we know, based on all of the archaeological and the textual evidence, houses and tombs were intentionally in the time of Jesus located at some distance from each other. Mm-hmm. And so I think the chances are extremely small that this is the house of Jesus. I think it's a very bizarre archaeological site. And it is, well, we like to say that if you're going to make an extraordinary claim, you need extraordinary evidence. Mm-hmm. And this is a very extraordinary claim, which is not well supported, as far as I can see to this point, by good evidence.
Well, we'll come back to that maybe in a little while. Shahar, just coming back to you, and when it comes to whether overall you feel that your research and the what you've seen in archaeology, has it confirmed or served to disconfirm, on average, the New Testament accounts?
Well, again, if we're looking into the details, that is up to the resolution one can search for. As a historian, my main field is history, which means I rely upon documents. Mm. When we cross evidence with documents from the same time, we find out that I have no doubt about the existence of historical Jesus. Neither Jesus nor the disciples and the evangelists are a riddle to me. They are real people who actually lived in that time, because when we cross evidence with different documents, and that goes the same with archaeological excavations, much of what we read upon is very much correct. And scientific things can prove the existence of inhabitations, of roads, of merchandising, and of the existence of different places. I would give an example, if I may.
Sure.
When Jesus comes to Jerusalem, actually he comes to Jerusalem from the presentation in the temple and so on every year as a pilgrim, because as every Jewish person in his time, they are pilgriming actually three times to the holy city of Jerusalem every time. But when he comes to Jerusalem, we are hearing from John, in John 5 and in John 9, we are learning upon two different miracles that Jesus performs in Jerusalem. One, which is described in John 5, is the miracle of healing of the lame person in the pools of Bethesda. And the second one is the healing of the blind person in the pool of Siloam. Both miracles have to do with the water pools, which is something very, very, I would say, similar and very profound for Jerusalem. Whoever understands Jerusalem knows that the water pools of Jerusalem must have been a very central place in that time, when people could actually see things that are happening there, because everybody would know where the water are, because Jerusalem is a city on the edge of the desert.
Mm.
The second thing when it comes to our mind is Pool of Siloam was recently rediscovered. What I mean to say is that for generations upon generations, we hear that pilgrims and people who are making voyages, I can use the word tourists of the ancient times, from Eusebius all the way through the traveler from Bordeaux in France in 333 AD that travels to Jerusalem, each and every one of them has visited the Pool of Siloam. Even Mark Twain, when he comes in the 19th century, speaks about the Pool of Siloam. The only thing they don't know is they're speaking about the wrong Pool of Siloam, which is the Byzantine pool that everybody knew from the Byzantine time.
Right.
None of them knew the Herodian actual Pool of Siloam, since it was completely taken off by the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and since it was simply covered with huge amounts of debris. And that pool has been excavated and completely unearthed in pieces on the size of it in 2004 to 2010. Actually reopened to the public recently, a few years ago. And when you come to that pool, one can actually understand huge amounts of knowledge about the times of Jesus, including what the pots of cooking looked like, what the dishes of eating looked like. We found there over 1,500 coins from the times of Jesus, over 30,000 pottery shreds, like, you know, pieces of pottery, which are dishes and things. And the amazing thing is, if you read the scriptures, John 9, you know, verses 7 and 8, he talks to the blind person once he spits on the ground, takes some soil, and puts it on the brow of the blind man, and he tells him, "My son, go down to the pool of Siloam and wash your face." And you're asking yourself, would you meet a blind person in the middle of London today and do that to him and tell him, go there?
Mm.
A blind man should not go somewhere he doesn't know, like the palm of his hand.
Yeah.
Meaning, if you know the route that actually connected the Pool of Siloam to the Temple Mount at that time, which was actually recovered a few years ago, and now we know it, only when you see that road of pilgrimage in the times of Jesus, one can understand why is a blind man possible to actually do it without seeing anything. Because that main street was so well known to him that he could actually go down from the top of the city from the Temple Mount all the way down to the Pool of Siloam and wash his face. Because he could actually find the Pool of Siloam. Now, only now we understand that, because we have dug the Pool of Siloam and we can see it. There, by the way, a person can actually walk in the footsteps of Jesus where the blind man was healed.
Yeah, right there. It's a fascinating insight into what is, for many people, a very familiar story from John. I mean, there are, of course, skeptics. Many of them exist online who doubt altogether the existence of Jesus these days, and certainly believe that many of the stories were simply made up later on. Do you find that these kinds of finds that corroborate these stories of Jesus's day are act then as evidence that we can trust that these events really did take place?
So again, as a scientist, I have no doubt about the existence of these figures. I have no doubt about the existence of the history around these figures. The interpretation as people of faith might be different, because the things have occurred. Whether miracles have been occurring as is, as described, that is a question which a theologist should be answering,
sure.
Not me.
Right.
As a scientist, I can look at many of the things described in the time of Jesus, and I can actually affirm them through findings of archaeology today, through historical documents.
Yes,
today,
you can say it's consistent with the background that's being described and the places and so on.
Very much.
Yeah. Byron, do you generally agree with what Shahar is saying here, or do you have any other take on this?
Right, absolutely. I think he's made a really good point, and that's a particularly exciting discovery, that pool. And it's one of a number which, taken in connection with not just the biblical text, but the writings of ancient historians like Josephus, I don't think there's any legitimate doubt that Jesus of Nazareth existed. There's a sort of early adolescent skepticism that some people never grow out of, and God bless them. But those are not, that extreme skepticism, did Jesus exist, is not something that is taken with any degree of seriousness at the table where the grown-ups are sitting. Now, the significance of Jesus can be debated at some length. But his existence is it's not reasonable to call that into question. The convergence of archaeological and textual evidence, both in and outside of Christianity, is more than strong enough for us to conclude that he most certainly did exist.
And would you say that the preponderance of the discoveries in archaeology have kind of confirmed in that sense? I mean, I know that a lot was made when, I think, was it in the 1960s, the inscription of Pilate,
right,
was discovered and so on. And up to that time, I think there had only been a few scattered documents that suggested Pilate's governorship at the time of Jesus. But then this inscription on a tablet was found that seems, again, to corroborate the location, the events that people like Luke and Matthew are describing in their gospel. So do you find that that's generally continued as archaeology has continued in your experience?
Yeah, it has, and there are just any number of times where we find ourselves looking at a biblical text against the archaeological background and saying, oh, that fits. One of the first articles I ever wrote in my scholarly career was about the saying, let the dead bury their dead, their own dead, prior to archaeological discoveries in the second half of the 20th century, nobody paid much attention to how they buried their dead back then. But if you look at their practice of what's called secondary burial, that is, they buried the dead on the day of their death and then came back a year later and gathered up the bones when that was all that was left, there are actually two burials, in other words. That saying makes perfect sense against that background, and in fact is only comprehensible against that background. And so so there's just been case after case. We could be here all week going on about the places where archaeology and the biblical text are mutually illuminating. But as I said earlier, there are also times when the archaeology helps us see that the writers may not have understood the environment especially well, or have, and this is very common in the Christian sources, they have perhaps aggrandized Jesus' role a little bit. I'll give one quick example here having to do with the temple and the so-called cleansing of the temple. You know, if you look at the archaeology of that structure and the so-called Stoa Basileia, the large covered area at the south end of the temple where the money changers and the sellers of animals were doing their work, it would have been impossible for one human being to substantially disrupt those activities. What Jesus did was a small demonstration in a small area for a few moments. Mm. But of course, if you disrupt the functioning of the temple at Passover, that is serious, whether it's a minor or a major disruption.
Right.
He was seen, he was noticed, and he was a marked man from that moment. But we should not imagine that the whole commerce of the temple came to a halt.
Came to a grinding halt because of some tables
exactly.
knocked over.
Exactly.
Interesting stuff. We're going to have to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment's time. We're asking today, does archaeology support the New Testament? So pleased to have two experts in their field with me today, Shahar Shiloh, a biblical historian and archaeologist, coming over actually to the UK late June, June 22nd to the 26th. And you can book in to hear him speaking across the country with walkwherejesuswalked.com. Byron McCain joins me as well, biblical archaeologist and Indiana Jones lookalike, who is going to be continuing to talk about his work excavating parts of the desert and the Israel and so on as we continue this discussion together. Come back in just a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we find out why Christianity is under attack where the church is growing fastest, in Africa. We speak to pro wrestling star Shawn Michaels on his conversion to Christ. R.T. Kendall shares an open letter to the UK church. And we ask whether Christians should watch horror movies, as Jonty Langley makes the case for scary films. Get your free copy today and check out the news, reviews and brilliant columnists too.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's edition of Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. Today asking, does archaeology support the New Testament? If you'd like to get in touch, perhaps you've been able to go out and visit the ruins and the sites of historic interest in Israel and elsewhere. I'd love to hear from you on your views on this, whether you're sceptical or convinced about the archaeological record as it pertains to the New Testament. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable is where you can find today's show and leave a comment there if you'd like to feedback that way, or email unbelievable@premier.org.uk to send me an email. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme, of course. At UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, facebook.com/unbelievableJB if you want to get in touch via the Facebook page. Shahar Shiloh joins me today on the show, biblical historian and archaeologist, are going to be visiting the UK soon for a number of seminars discussing new archaeological finds which he believes reconfirm the narrative of the New Testament. He's speaking in the UK from the 22nd to the 26th of June. For info on the dates and places, walkwherejesuswalked.com. My other guest is Dr. Byron McCain, biblical archaeologist and professor of religion at Swofford University, South Carolina, involved in many excavations and digs in the course of his research. And we've already been hearing about some of the finds that they're spoken about, which both speak for and sometimes not in favour of some of the accounts in the New Testament. So we'll be continuing to look at some of that in the course of the rest of today's show. Shahar, coming back to you then, I know that the temple probably is something you've been interested in yourself. Does that cohere with you, what Byron was saying there, that sometimes we may get a slightly different picture from Scripture than when we actually look at the environment of the thing and say, OK, well, maybe it didn't quite happen as we seem to have imagined it from that scriptural story. Maybe it wasn't Jesus turning over all the temples and tables and it all grinding to a halt. It was more like a demonstration in one corner of the square. Does that cohere with your understanding too?
Yes, very much. If I may support Professor McCain, because he just said something interesting about ossuaries in the world of burial at the time. If I may just give you an example, mm-hmm. what we're looking at, Ezekiel, for instance, his amazing describing of his prophecy would not be understood for someone who doesn't understand the way they buried their dead in that time. I'm sure Professor McGann would join me gladly here, because we're talking about the prophecies of so many prophets. One can have a hard time understanding what they speak about if he doesn't know the daily life of the Second Temple period. And that goes the same with the Temple Mount. If I may just give you a good story here, another example.
Go ahead.
If one is to walk today, there is Israel Museum. There is a new interesting insight in the Israel Museum, which is called the Christian Path of Evidence. This is a 12 stations exhibition. Basically, the exhibition is within the archaeological hall, which is a huge, one of the largest, you know, collections and exhibitions that exist in the ancient world, is within the Israel Museum. And that is made out of 12 places that one can go and see the biblical truth and the biblical proofs for the existence of biblical and New Testament stories. For instance, if one is to discuss right now the Temple Mount, there is a great inscription, an amazing one, that was once a part of an inscription in Greek surrounding the fence of the temple. The temple was fenced, and in certain times, one could not be a Gentile and pass that fence, because if he is, he will be executed. Now, that inscription from the times of Jesus is so beautiful because it says in Greek, because it is meant for the Gentiles, a Gentile shall not pass this corner, because this is inappropriate.
Sure.
So one can see today in the Israel Museum, along with the amazing Pontius Pilate inscription, which proves the existence of that procurator at the same time. So, yes, I think that up to a certain degree, we can find the evidence within the scriptures on one side and the archaeological world on the other side. In certain resolutions, it is very hard from the distance of 2,000 years to prove resolution of small facts.
Sure. I mean, turning to the issue of burial, I'll invite Byron to come in on this as well in a moment. Obviously, one of the key stories in the New Testament, of course, is the death and burial of Jesus Christ. How much is the way that's described in the Gospels reflected in what we do find in terms of burial traditions from the first century as we've excavated tombs?
Well, the descriptions... Well, I would say, sincerely, that descriptions are very, very, very thorough and very much exact. Up to a certain level, of course, of resolution, depends who writes exactly and where is he at the time of writing.
Sure.
But not only this, a new excavation which has been conducted in a church, a German church of the Lutheran Church, which is, I would say, 100 yards maybe from the Church of Holy Sepulchre, has actually recovered the walls of the time of Jesus. Mm. Which makes us understand today that even that for generations, since General Gordon has found the, what we call the Golgotha and the Garden Tomb, and has actually established the association of the Garden Tomb, which is a place where a lot of Anglicans and a lot of Protestants are going today to look for the place where Jesus was buried.
Mm.
Actually, in the last decade, they do not even say that this is the place of crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus anymore. They refer to it as the atmosphere and the surroundings and the serenity that one can experience when he wants to see what used to be in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago in the times of Jesus.
Mm.
But very much except that the Church of Holy Sepulchre, where it stands today, which has its Catholic part and the Orthodox part, is very much an exact, you know, an exact example of what should we look for, because the empty tomb is actually a Jewish empty tomb from the times of Jesus. So we should very much expect that everything we find within the tombs around Jerusalem, including ossuaries and later on sarcophagus, which are being used afterwards, they match the scriptures in a unique way that one cannot really disprove.
Right. Let's bring Byron in at this point. I think many people who read the New Testament accounts aren't obviously necessarily familiar with the way that people in first century Judaism buried their dead. So do you agree, Byron, that the description of how what happened to Jesus's body broadly fits what you find in the archaeological evidence?
Well, somewhat, and then, you know, sometimes it doesn't. There is a clear tendency, if we line the Gospels up in their historical order, Mark is the earliest, Luke and Matthew come next, and John is last. There is a clear tendency in those accounts to improve and beautify and aggrandize the burial of Jesus. I and several other New Testament scholars familiar with the archaeology have argued that Jesus was actually given a criminal's burial. There is in both Jewish and ancient Roman tradition, and this is in fact still the case in societies, say like where I live, where capital punishment is still carried out. A victim of capital punishment never gets a normal burial. They never get an honorable burial. They get a burial in shame or dishonor. And Jesus' burial in the Gospels is right down the line consistent with how both Romans and Jews would have wanted to bury a convicted criminal. And so it is not a it is typical of those practices at the time, but it's not typical of an ordinary burial. It's typical of a criminal's burial, which is exactly what we should expect.
Describe what an ordinary burial would have usually looked like then, as opposed to a criminal burial.
Right. And in an ordinary burial in Jewish tradition, the family gathers as quickly as possible at the home. The body is prepared. Relatives and friends come. The body is washed and wrapped and then carried to the tomb and placed in the tomb by sunset. There begins at this point a series of mourning rituals, the first one lasting for 7 days, the next one for the first month. And the rituals of mourning do not end until the first anniversary of the death. Here in the States, Jewish families still mark the first anniversary of the death of a loved one with what they call the unveiling, the official placing of the headstone on the grave. And all of these have long, deep roots in Jewish tradition. But a criminal gets one thing, prompt burial, and that's it. There are no mourning for a criminal. And the criminal is not buried in the family tomb. A criminal is buried in a separate tomb reserved for criminals. This is all according to the Mishnah, an early Jewish text about which writes about law and practice and religious norms. This is significant because, of course, all of the texts agree that the death of Jesus came as a result of political authorities deciding that he needed to be executed. It's quite common in human societies for executed criminals not to receive a normal burial, and Jesus doesn't. He is very promptly buried in a tomb, but it's not it's not his family tomb, and no one sits Shiva. No one mourns for him. The women alone come back on the Sunday morning to try to give him some basic considerations.
It is an interesting thing then. At the same time, obviously, we get this account, at least in one of the Gospels, that Joseph of Arimathea gave a tomb for Jesus to be placed into and so on. I mean, is there any way of verifying any of that kind of detail, or is that simply the kind of thing we can't have access to from the archaeological records?
Joseph of Arimathea is not mentioned in any other ancient source, so we really don't know anything about him except that he appears in this one biblical story. It might well have made sense that a good, observant Jewish leader would have not wanted Jesus to be treated the way many Roman crucifixion victims were treated, and that is to be left on the cross even for days at a time. You know, the Romans were trying to send a message with crucifixion, and sometimes they wanted that message to stay up there for a while. So Joseph may, you know, perhaps he was a Christian, but he doesn't have to have been to have wanted a Jewish execution victim to be taken down off the cross before sunset, especially at that time, Passover. So, you know, on my view, it's not necessary to think that Joseph was a Christian. He would just have been an observant devout Jew who wanted to do what was right and decent.
Sure. Well, let's bring in Shehar again at this point. Shehar, I wonder if you've got any observations on any of the things that Byron has had to say there.
Well,
Well, first, I very much agree. The resolution that Byron is specializing in when it comes to burial is that's his field of research, and he certainly knows much more than I do about that. I agree with whatever he said so far, because this knowledge comes through archaeology today, gives us a very clear understanding of many of the different, you know, inhabitants of Jerusalem at the time, and especially when it comes to Jewish burial. If I may, I wish to take you for a moment to the Galilee, to one new excavation that was taken in 2009 and demonstrates again our understanding of that time, because the amazing synagogue of Magdala was found in late 2009, and ever since it's been excavated by both the Israeli Authority of Antiquities and the local Franciscans, which are doing excellent job. And the Magdala is one of the most impressive places one can actually go in a synagogue that Jesus has preached in. And if we are taking under consideration the importance of Mary Magdalene in the story, in the early ancient stories, including the beautiful scriptures that were found in Najd Hammadi in Egypt some 70 years ago. And if you take that under consideration, so the proof that comes out from Magdala and the future proof that would come out from Bethsaida. Bethsaida is being excavated by the Chicago University by Professor Rami Arav for the last 15 years. And the amount of things that comes out from the Christian times Bethsaida, which is one of the cursed villages that was cursed by Jesus due to them unrecognizing his miracles in the Galilee. When I look at these sites and I look at the scriptures, I find similarities which are overwhelming and breathtaking, as Professor McCain said before. So in my world, every day is a new day, and the shining of the sun upon each, you know, different excavation in different places in Israel that goes along with the Bible. I'm saying this to be as clear as possible.
Sure.
None of these excavations has disproven the Bible so far. They all either support the stories or don't relate to the stories sometimes, which is fine.
Sure.
But none of them disproves it, so it's exciting to me.
We're talking about whether archaeology supports the New Testament on today's show. Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And just a reminder of who's joining me today, Shahar Shiloh and Dr. Byron McCain, both experts in their field, biblical historians and archaeologists, talking about some of the most recent findings in the Middle East, in Israel specifically, and whether they confirm or disconfirm the narrative of the New Testament. We're interested in having an honest look at these kinds of issues, and I hope you enjoy what you're hearing on the program today. If you hear anything that you want to dispute, come back on, then obviously feel free to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch by one of the other ways that you can find from the website. Don't forget, Unbelievable, available as a podcast. Many thousands of people listen every month to the podcast. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for all of the links.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
If I may then play devil's advocate here and bring up the fact that one part of archaeology that has been disputed as to whether it disproves effectively the stories of Jesus is Nazareth. And I know that some people have written accounts. I'm thinking of there's one particular person called René Salm who's written something called The Myth of Nazareth, who claim that Nazareth really never existed in the time of Jesus, or if it did, it certainly wasn't a town. It was, nothing more than a tiny hamlet, if anything. Yet it seems to have been sort of cast by the writers of the Gospels as a town that Jesus grew up in. But the archaeological evidence doesn't support that. What's your view on that, Shahar?
As I understand, and I would very much like my colleague to answer, as this is his field of expertise, but as I understand so far from the new findings, that does not disprove the existence of Nazareth. It just makes it smaller.
Right.
And small places in the Jewish times, especially after the destruction of the temple, where it changes, would have synagogues. Now, if I may say something here, then we may have a synergy of a writer who wrote his views when synagogues were more to be found. Because sure. At the times of the existence of the temple, synagogues were very rare. We need to know that so far there are less than 10 synagogues which are simultaneously existing with the time of the temple. So far in Israel, there's 9 so far. We may discover some more, but this does not disprove the existence of Nazareth. The only thing is that the story of Jesus preaching in the synagogue of Nazareth might have been taken from later times and, may I say, bonded, glued to the story. This does not disprove the existence of Nazareth.
Right. What's your take on Nazareth and that whole controversy then, Byron?
We've known for some time that Nazareth was a tiny little wide spot in the road, as we would put it here in the American South. It's no place you want to be from because it's not going to impress anybody. One of the ways that we knew this was we are aware of a number of ancient first century tombs in Nazareth, and it was the custom that tombs were always located outside of town. So if you trace the arc of the locations of the tombs, you can tell that Nazareth must have been a very small town. So it's not at all surprising to find out that it was. I mean, we've known that for a while. But did it exist? Of course it did. And there were plenty of tiny little settlements. There's one that's as yet unexcavated, not far from Nazareth, called Chorvat Roma. And it would have been a little wide spot in the road with only a few hundred people.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that we also get that story again in John of Nathanael saying, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" It obviously wasn't regarded as being a place of great stature in its
right
in that
and
sense.
People who were wealthy or refined or well educated would certainly have regarded Jesus of Nazareth as a they would have regarded him with some disrespect. I mean, he was not well educated. He was not economically well off. He lived from hand to mouth from day to day. He would have looked like a hobo.
Right.
Do you have that word in English?
Well, I know what you mean. A tramp at some level or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wasn't from the same socioeconomic class as possibly what a normal rabbi might have come from, I suppose, in that day and age.
There are these stories in the Bible where Jesus supposedly outwits the most educated people in the land at scriptural interpretation. I'm quite confident that if those stories ever took place, the educated people did not feel as if they had been outwitted.
That's an interesting point. I'll come back to you now, Shahar, and just as we start to wrap up today's program. Any other stories? I mean, fascinating story of Siloam and finding that path from the Temple Mount down to the Pool of Siloam. Anything else that you are particularly going to be highlighting as recent discoveries that for you confirm the historicity of the New Testament?
Well, I will be talking about new findings from Magdala, the new finding from Hippos, Susita, in the slopes of the Golan Heights, about the new findings of Bethsaida up north in the northern part of the Sea of Galilee, about the churches of the early Christianity of the Negev, where the Nabataeans have turned from pagans to Christians, and one can walk today in churches which are 1,500 years old. But if I may give you a quick story, which is overwhelming to me, is to understand why does Jesus perform only 2 miracles within Jerusalem, once having done over 30 different miracles in the Galilee? That is a question I ask myself when I read the scriptures. And when I went into the archaeological world of Jerusalem, I got the picture only when I read the Bible and the New Testament together. And this proves something which is a theological notion, should I say an insight, that we need to adopt. If you ask yourself, why does he do only 2 miracles in Jerusalem? The answer would be because he's going after his great-great-great-grandfather, King David. When King David tries to take over Jerusalem from the Jebusites 3,000 years ago, he's being mocked by the Jebusite king, who stands on the wall and says to him, "Thou shalt not come here until you remove the blind and the lame." And David hated the blind and the lame. That is from the second book of Samuel, chapter 5. Now, 1,000 years would pass away. David took over Jerusalem, and he called it the Fortress of Zion, right? He took over the Fortress of Zion, then he names it after his name, the City of David. And from that time, it would be the main part of the Judean kingdom. 1,000 years would pass away, and Jesus would come to Jerusalem after one millennium. See something amazing. He still addresses an issue. He needs to take over the blind and the lame. And the two only miracles that Jesus performs within Jerusalem, one in the pools of Bethesda, and that is the one of healing the lame, John 5, 1 to 8. And the second one is healing the blind in the pool of Siloam, which is John 9, 7 and 8. And when you read that, you understand that it has to do with the idea that Jerusalem, which is so significant, all the holidays are from the Holy Week of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the crucifixion and resurrection. It is way more important than the Galilee to Jesus. Mm. And still it got only two miracles. And now you can understand why. Theologically speaking, he needs to take over the curse of the Jebusite king that was upon the head of his great-great-great-grandfather, King David, and he marks it with grace and mercy. And he walks to Jerusalem, and he takes care of the blind and the lame, like his great-grandfather, but only this time not with power, but with mercy and grace.
Hmm. Yeah, well, very interesting sort of way of looking at it in that way, and kind of, working out why there might have been a difference in the sort of miracles performed in different places. If we're going to go to another quick break, and then we'll have final thoughts from you both. Thanks for joining me on the programme today. You're listening to Unbelievable, talking about whether archaeology supports the New Testament. If you're interested in getting in touch, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback later on too, do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or indeed send me your feedback via Facebook and Twitter, and I'll be giving out the ways to do that again a little bit later on in today's programme. Welcome back to the final part of today's programme. On Unbelievable today, we're asking whether archaeology, modern archaeological finds, support the New Testament. And we'll be going back to my guests Shahar Sholo and Dr. Byron McCain in a moment's time. Unbelievable, the programme that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon. And we'll be hearing some of your feedback a little bit later on in the programme. Next week on the show, we're doing the transgender debate in light of that Caitlyn Jenner story, or formerly Bruce Jenner, who's had sex change surgery, and that was a big story, a viral story, when he appeared, or she appeared, on the cover of Vanity Fair in a glossy photo shoot as a woman. So we're going to be talking to a current transgender Christian, Jenny Ann Baker, and an ex-transgender Christian, Walt Heyer. Very different perspectives on the show join me to debate the issue of transgenderism. So look out for that. Same time next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking. But later on today, on the profile between 4 and 5, continue to listen here on Faith Explore to Matt Redman. He's in conversation with Steve Fanstone. Matt Redman, well-known worship leader around the world, and sat down to talk about his life, faith and ministry. He's got a new album coming out called Unbroken Praise. One of the interesting stories he told, and we've written this up on the Premier Christianity magazine blog this last week, is about a song that he's well known for, 10,000 Reasons. And what we discovered was that that song was sung by a group of 8 executed Bali prisoners. They had been executed for drug smuggling. Well, 7 of the 8 had become Christians while in the time of their incarceration. And there were reports at the time that they were shot literally singing Amazing Grace and this song by Matt Redman, 10,000 Reasons. And Matt Redman spoke about that. So you'll hear about that later on the profile between 4 and 5. But if you want to read the blog where we tell the whole story and Matt's reaction to that, why not visit the website of Premier Christianity, premierchristianity.com. You can also avail yourself of a free copy of the latest magazine. And the July edition has just landed, believe it or not. So we're well ahead of the game, and loads of interesting issues, articles, interviews, and so on. PremierChristianity.com/free sample if you want to get a free sample copy of the very latest magazine. Also worth mentioning that it was a big week for Premier Christian Radio this last week. If you haven't heard, we turned 20. Yes, the first day of broadcast was on June the 10th, 1995. I was 15 at the time. I was not part of Premier at the time, I should hasten to add. But nonetheless, we've had a wonderful 20 years, lots of ups and downs along the way. And believe it or not, Unbelievable has been going for nearly half that time. It'll be 10 years since the show first aired coming up in November. But to celebrate the birthday, as we do every year, we had a premier lecture. And this week it was John Lennox, well-known mathematician, Christian thinker and apologist. And he gave the premier lecture on the theme of Daniel, which is the theme of his latest book called Against the Flow. If you weren't able to listen to that on Thursday evening when we broadcast it, it is now available to listen to on the website at premierchristianradio.com. I'm going to actually be making sure to play it out, though, in a future edition of Unbelievable, perhaps on a weekend when we don't have a normal show because we've got our fundraising event or something like that. So listen out for that, or at least look out for that in your podcast feed if you're a podcast listener, as you'll be able to hear his lecture and indeed the Q&A that followed it in a future edition of the podcast of Unbelievable. So just a few of the details and things to come. We've got your feedback still to come as well, of course, and some interesting reflections on recent shows. But before we get to any of that, let's finish our discussion on archaeology and whether it supports the New Testament. My guests today, Shahar Shiloh and Dr. Byron McCain.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Byron, thank you very much for joining me on the programme today. It's been really interesting to have your input onto the show. What do you think is next in terms of what we might be able to dig up from the ground and discover about the biblical world that Jesus lived in?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the best thing about archaeology is that we're constantly being surprised. Things come out of the ground and they're always a little different than we think they're going to be. And that's the charm and delight of it. But I think I would mention one topic that we haven't touched on yet, and that is the importance of Herod the Great, this bad guy in the Bible who tries to kill all the babies in Bethlehem, and Jesus escapes. Herod the Great in the archaeological record is a massively important and very constructive presence in early Roman Palestine. And we are increasingly aware of how important he was. And I'll sketch that out very quickly. Of course, Herod was Rome's agent in Palestine. He was their man in charge on their behalf. And he did a remarkable job of bringing the land of Palestine into the Roman Empire. He Romanized it. Many of the things we've been talking about are actually effects of Romanization. The crucifixion of Jesus. Why are Romans there at all? Migdal, which Shahar mentioned earlier and really is a spectacular site, quite a prosperous town. By contrast, Nazareth is a little wide spot in the road and not prosperous at all. Romanization, frankly, is similar to globalization today in that it creates economic disruptions and economic inequalities. Some people, after Herod arrives on behalf of the Romans, some people get very rich. And other people find that their way of life is totally disrupted. In that setting, Jesus appears to have emerged as a voice for the disprivileged, for the people who are getting the short end of the stick in this new world order that's emerging.
I wonder whether that coheres with the way you see things as well, Shahar.
Well, I have to say that I love this notion very much, and I think that it's a very profound way of looking at things, because Romanization is like globalization today, and it brings huge amounts of things which were not only accepted but not completely unknown in Judea at the time. And if you read the Mishnah, there are different debates among the earliest commentators, these really, really important rabbis, about the importance of Rome and about the deeds of Rome. And when they do that, they talk about what Rome did for the kingdom of Judea. And I really like this profound understanding, because I accept King Herod, especially after the excavation that were done in Herodium. From 2007 and on, Herodium is being excavated, and we are actually right now, I just come back from Herodium a few days ago, and the findings that are there right now from the last year are overwhelming by all means, because now we understand what did King Herod actually plan for himself when he understood that he will be buried in Herodium, because when he built Herodium, it was not meant to be his tomb. And that person really is the key factor to the understanding of the times of Jesus. So I totally accept the profound notions that Professor McCain just said right now. Yeah. And there's much more that I can add about different stories, but, for this, I'm going to come to England, and there are some things that are going to stay in the box until I'm there.
Okay, well, we'll give you that privilege. And if you do want to catch up with any of the stories and new discoveries and how they intersect with the stories in the New Testament, then do check out the tour that Shahar is on shortly here in the UK from the 22nd to 26th of June. walkwherejesuswalked.com if you want to find out more. And if people are interested in finding out more about your work as well, Byron, you're a part of Swofford University. That's swofford.edu, I think, if people want to find the website. But, I mean, if someone's just interested generally in this area and thinks, maybe that's something I could do, maybe I could take a course in archaeology. What's the best way of going about things, would you say?
Yeah, you know, there are many colleges and universities which will have evening courses for the general public. Archaeology is an absolutely fascinating subject, and everyone should find out everything they can about it. To find out more about my work, it's probably best just to Google my name, Byron R. McCain, M-C-C-A-N-E, and you'll find my website there with a number of links. The excavation of which I'm currently co-director is called Horvat Kur, H-O-R-V-A-T-K-U-R. And if you Google Horvat Kur, you'll find all about our dig there. And that can be a gateway into many, many other discoveries online about archaeology and the Bible.
Well, it's been fascinating to share the time with you. Thank you so much for giving up time, gentlemen, both, to tell us about your work and all the interesting digs you've been on and how they're intersecting with the Bible today. And if you want more information on Shahar or Byron, do go to the webpage of today's programme at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. In the meantime, I'll say thank you very much both for being with me on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
As ever, if you want to get in touch, it's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable to leave a comment underneath the latest show. And if you're there, you can subscribe to the podcast if you're not already subscribing. You can also, of course, email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Send me a message or drop me a tweet at unbelievablejb for the Twitter account, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, to follow the show on the Facebook page. And I try to post up some interesting stuff during the week as well. Another something I noticed was a big feature in The Guardian on Richard Dawkins this last week, which they had quite a bit of commentary on as well. So look out for some of those things at the Unbelievable Facebook page if you get the chance to drop by. Just before we get to some of your feedback, I was interested when we recorded this debate, this discussion on archaeology, in that whole thing about, Nazareth was a pretty small sort of hamlet, a town, a village, really, in modern terms. Was there a synagogue? That's disputed as far as the archaeological record is concerned. So I looked up some other alternative views on that and was interested to find this, I think, written by BillHerriman.com, his website. He says our archaeology has not yet uncovered a synagogue in Nazareth. But he goes on to talk about the fact that, in fact, in Jesus' day, Jewish custom required only 10 men in order to form a synagogue, a community, even if their synagogue building was merely a large room on the ground level of some other building. Of course, it might have been either, but Luke 7:5 sounds as if the synagogue building at Capernaum was the city's first ever corporately owned, specifically allocated communal construction. And since Capernaum was probably a hair better off than Nazareth economically, it seems very possible that Jesus' family and neighbours actually gathered in a converted home or something similar. So he goes on to say, my only point is that we don't need archaeology in this case to expect that the Jewish community of Nazareth held gatherings in some place or another during Jesus's early life, whether they utilized part of a shared building or had somehow afforded themselves a proper meeting house. The synagogue was the community, and this is a well-established fact, true before 70 AD, and clearly clears the way for us to ask the next logical question, given that there was almost certainly a synagogue association or gathering of some sort in Nazareth during the Lord's silent years. To what extent did Jesus participate in it? And for that matter, what precisely did they do? And Bruce continues his exploration of that on his blog there. I just thought that was interesting because I'd never really thought about the in Luke 4 when it talks about Jesus returning to Nazareth, his hometown, and speaking in the synagogue. Could that have been simply a room in someone's house, effectively, as they may not have had sort of purpose-built synagogues in that day and age? All sorts of interesting things you learn on this programme, aren't there, that may help you to sort of have a better appreciation of Bible times. In any case, that was just one thing. And just another quick thing before we get to some of your feedback. I've been in touch recently with a friend of the show, Peter Byram. He's been working on something rather special. It's a talk that William Lane Craig, a well-known American philosopher and Christian thinker, gave while he was in the UK earlier in the year at Highfield Church in Southampton. The talk was called Cosmology, a Religion for Atheists, and working off the recent film, The Theory of Everything, featuring the life of Stephen Hawking, William Lane Craig talks about modern cosmology and whether it provides evidence for the existence of God. Well, that talk isn't quite yet available on YouTube, but the trailer is. Yes, we're into the trailers now for apologetics talks. So listen to this and see what you think.
I'm a cosmologist.
What's that?
In the award-winning movie, The Theory of Everything, Stephen Hawking introduces himself to his wife-to-be, Jane, as a cosmologist. When Jane asks what that is, he replies, "It's a kind of religion for intelligent atheists." That remark is both provocative and revealing.
What if I reverse the process all the way back to see what happened at the beginning of time itself?
The film focuses on two cosmogonic theories which Stephen Hawking has defended. The first being the standard Big Bang model based entirely on the general theory of relativity.
A singularity.
Space-time singularity.
And the second being the so-called no boundary proposal, which Hawking developed in collaboration with James Hartle, based on the incorporation of quantum physics. The film explores the alleged theological implications of these two theories. Jonathan, I thought that you proved that the universe had a beginning and thus a need for a creator. My mistake. Hawking says, no, mine. Jane says, Stephen is looking for a single theory that explains all the forces in the universe. Therefore, God must die.
There should be no boundaries to human endeavor. While there is life,
there is hope.
You're jumping to the conclusion that there must be a supernatural reason. It seems to be based on the assumption that there's no more to learn.
Do you think scientists like Stephen Hawking do themselves a disservice by going out to try and prove a point that God is necessary or unnecessary?
No, I don't. Not at all. What I think they do as a disservice is not studying some philosophy before they do it. Yes, I value their input, I want their input, but they need to exert the same effort to understand philosophy that I as a philosopher have exerted in trying to honestly understand physical cosmology.
Yes, Peter's done an amazing job on this trailer, so I'm sure it'll be an equally grand job on the talk in full when it's available on YouTube. So look out for that coming soon, and I'll make sure you know about it once it's available as well. Okay, let's go to some of your feedback. Mark in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania says, I've just finished 8 years worth of Unbelievable episodes and I love them all. Not only do you have an accent that I could listen to all day, but the content is top notch as well. Your topics are always great, including conditional immortality and middle knowledge, both of which I find compelling. I'd be extremely interested in hearing a oneness Trinitarian debate. I recall 3 episodes related to the Trinity and 2 of them faced off against Islam. The other episode featured Anthony Buzzard, but I do not feel his Unitarian views hold water. In my research, only the oneness position about the personal nature of God makes any sense. Would you be willing to host a show on this topic? I have someone in mind whose oneness theological writings are very cogent and informative, and have asked if he's interested. If you both are willing, I'm sure it would make for a great show versus a Trinitarian representative. And you also would love to hear shows about if the Sabbath is on Saturday and whether Christians should rest on that, and if the state is moral vis-a-vis Christianity and anarcho-capitalism. Thank you for all the great ideas, Mark. And yes, a oneness Trinitarian debate would be very interesting. See if we can go anywhere with that. But more to the point, 8 years of unbelievable episodes listened to. I wonder how long it took you to get through those. But well done, you. And yes, you probably know the back catalogue better than I do at this point in time, Mark. Thanks for being such a dedicated listener via podcast. I know there are many others of you who listen via podcast who have literally listened to years and years worth of programmes. I mentioned earlier we will be celebrating 10 years of Unbelievable towards the end of this year. We didn't start podcasting the show till a couple of years in, hence you can't get the full 10-year back catalogue, as it were. But it'll be fun to review some of the many shows we've had over the years once that opportunity comes. Let's also look at what William in Guyana, South America, had to say about last week's programme. We were talking about prayer. Does it make sense? Former Christian Ed Atkinson was in dialogue with David Wilkinson, principal of St John's College, Durham, who's written a new book on prayer. So William says, it's impossible to pray correctly without the enabling control of the Holy Spirit. From Romans 8:26, 1 Corinthians 14:18. Paul admits that his greatest testimony is that he prays in an unknown language more than all of the believers present. But many are disappointed in the answers to prayer. No surprise. Jesus suggested that whenever we pray, we should say, Our Father who art in heaven, etc. That's not a bedtime poem or a rallying creed at Mass, but rather a list of matters that God is committed to holding meaningful discussions on 24/7, i.e. his fatherhood, his residence, his holiness, his kingdom, his will, right through to the eternal worship of his glory. Ask, but we can ask amiss. Seek, but we can search for something God isn't interested in. Knock, but we can knock on a door which God has closed or has no intention of opening. And you conclude by saying, William, prayer, therefore, is simply spiritually breathing God's fresh air of the beauty of his existence and will. That's why we shouldn't stop doing it. In Jesus' name, in dedication to what Jesus is currently working on, not just the comfort of human beings, even of his church, but the systematic destruction of rebel principalities and the works of darkness. And the last enemy to be destroyed will be death. Thanks for that response. So Margaret says, I've had ME for 26 years, and I certainly agree that prayer can be a mystery. But this illustration from James Dobson has helped me. His son, at about 2 years, needed a medical procedure. Not painful, but involved probing the child's ear. James had to hold his screaming son down, one of the most difficult things he'd ever had to do, and saw briefly in his eyes the accusation, Even you, who I thought I could trust, even you are doing this dreadful thing to me. James could have explained to his son, but no way would the child have understood. And I believe God always answers and that the Bible supports that, but the answer might be no or beyond our understanding. We have to remember that we can only see such a minuscule amount of God's immense, far-reaching purposes. I suggest that what we can understand enables us to trust when we can't understand. Thank you again for the programme. Lovely thoughts, Margaret. Appreciate that. I tell a very similar story sometimes when I'm presenting a talk on why does God allow suffering, of when my youngest child, Jeremy, soon not to be youngest, actually, we're expecting our fourth, believe it or not, very shortly. But at least at this moment in time, our youngest child, Jeremy, when he was born, had a skin condition that he picked up in birth. And he had to go on antibiotics for about a week in hospital. And I had to be there, just literally this baby, only hours old, as the doctor had to insert a cannula, a needle, into his tiny little wrist, bend it back. It looked excruciating. And I had to be there dropping little bits of sugar water in his mouth to try and keep him calm as the doctor had to do his necessary work. And I wished I could have got down to his level and told him, the doctor doesn't hate you, you know, we're sorry we have to do this from the moment you're born. But I couldn't, you know, and I do see that as a picture of the way we often can't see the big picture that God can see when it comes to the stuff going on around us and what his greater purposes might be. But in any case, thank you for a story that made me think of that myself. This is a really interesting email. Someone who simply goes by the pseudonym Doubting Thomas has emailed in, says, I write to you as a desperately hopeful yet frequently disillusioned believer. wanting to believe in the efficacy of prayer, as described by David Wilkinson on your latest show. I lost my would-be father-in-law to brain cancer a little over a half a year ago, despite all the prayers for healing from an army of believers in our community. However, even with us praying boldly for his healing for hours, my father-in-law's condition went downhill fast and he passed away with my fiancé still holding his hand. I want to believe that the prayer of a righteous man is powerful and effective, but when it had come to praying for terminally ill relatives and friends in my life, every one of them that the doctor said would die has died, without exception. I consoled myself by thinking that prayer is not about changing God, but rather about changing the believer. But now I've trouble ascribing even that power to prayer. You see, for close to a decade, I've been plagued by habits of masturbation and more recently, occasional use of pornography. Despite having prayed for transformation and rescue in this area for the same number of years, it remains a foothold of Satan in my life. And now, after the Spirit and older Christians convicted me to confess it to my fiancé, threatens to unravel my soon-to-be marriage. Now I find myself on my knees every night and praying constantly at work for deliverance from this temptation, but I honestly don't know if prayer will even be able to transform me in this way. The habit has been so long informing and I've been praying against it for so long, and yet I desperately need this deliverance and transformation now for the sake of my future marriage and the woman who means more to me than anything except for God. If you really believe in the power of prayer to work miracles by transforming a person from the old man to a new man, as I believe wholeheartedly that you do, please pray for me. Same for all your listeners, if they're so inclined. More than any other prayer in my life, I desire for the power of prayer to be shown here. Says Doubting Thomas. What an extraordinary story. Well, Doubting Thomas, if I may give you some of my personal counsel on this, it is a huge area, unanswered prayer. It's so sad. We all experience people dying who we don't want to die. That is the reality of life. And we can only say that, obviously, prayers do go unanswered in the way we'd like them to be on that front. There are some excellent resources out there from people like Pete Gregg. God on Mute is an excellent book that I could recommend to talk about when God doesn't seem to answer our prayers in the way we want to. And indeed, obviously, David Wilkinson's book that we were talking about last week. On the issue of pornography and masturbation, which is a massive issue, I think, for men particularly today, I would say, firstly, I would hope your fiancé would understand that this is a problem common to so many men. You are hardly the first man for this to affect in that sense. But the other thing is that if you're looking for an answer to prayer, perhaps a very practical way of having an answer to that prayer would be to simply look into some of the resources that are out there, online resources, things like XXXchurch.com, who offer software that can make you accountable to other people in this area, that can really help with people who struggle with that. Indeed, there's a very recent new online support network group available called clicktokick.com. You might want to try that. But, you know, at the end of the day, you've recognized it's something you want to deal with and tackle. And I hope that your fiancé might be able to see that to some extent that requires a lot more integrity than many people who simply don't even regard this as an issue in their life. In any case, my prayers are with you, Doubting Thomas. I'm sure many people who are listening who can sympathise as well with where you're at are also similarly praying. Thank you for listening today to Unbelievable. It's been an interesting programme, hasn't it? And whatever you've heard and whatever you'd like to feedback on, be interested to hear back from you. Again, email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Next week, we'll definitely include some more time for some of your reflections on various things from the last few weeks. More of your response to that debate between Eugenie Scott and Ruth Bansovitz on whether faith is good for science, and loads of other stuff that you've been writing in on. If you want to listen back to any of the past shows, you know the web address, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And let me tell you about the hot button issue we're talking about next week.
You're unbelievable.
We're talking about Caitlyn Jenner and the transgender debate. Caitlyn Jenner, formerly Bruce Jenner, made the headlines in the last few weeks. The reality TV star, former sports athlete, came out as a woman on a Vanity Fair photo shoot, having undergone sex change therapy and operation. Okay, so what do we make of that as Christians? We're going to have two Christians debating from both sides of this perspective. Walt Heyer is an ex-transgender Christian. He became a woman for a number of years, but then reverted back to being a man, believe it or not. Jenny Ann Baker is a current trans woman who's a Christian as well. They'll be talking about that on the show that aims to get you thinking. Unbelievable. For the moment, thanks for listening to today's programme, and The Profile is here next.